Welcome to the Buddha Sasana Podcast. This talk was given by Bhikkhu Chintita in Austin, Texas.
Last week in my talk, Anatomy of a Conflict, I used a tiff between neighbors George and Bob to illustrate the typical structure of an interpersonal conflict. I highlighted the role of judgment in generating such a conflict. I should caution that the word judgment in English has a rather wide-ranging meaning, but I mean it in the sense of judgmentalness. It's a cognitive act different from simple evaluation. In fact, it is the end of evaluation. It's the decision that is all I need to know about this creep. The end of patience, closing the door on someone. This is a pervasive event in human affairs. It can occur quite casually or can be mixed in with anger and have severe consequences and even be achieved collectively as found in war or racial violence. The problem is that it's a form of delusion. It comes with the conviction that we are right and it deliberately shuts off any possibility of further investigation. In this sense, it dehumanizes or demonizes people, sometimes whole classes of people, since people are by nature actually of barely fathomable complexity. Judgment is the origin of violence, or we might even say judgment is violence. I think it's important for all of us to recognize in ourselves this impulse to judge, to detect when we cross that line, watch ourselves doing it. As Buddhists, we should always be vigilant about greed, hatred, and delusion in their many guises. For the impulse to violence, this should be even especially so. One of the dangers I've discovered in more than one of my students is that they seem to be absolutely convinced that when they make a judgment, they have complete and total insight into the person or people that they are dealing with, that they seem to think they have a special, almost supernatural gift of insight unique to themselves. This then shows up in unrelenting criticism of others expressed verbally either to the other's face or behind their backs. This is not appreciated by the others and puts them in almost constant conflict with others. I've had occasion to sit down with people like this and pointed out that they were violating Buddhist precepts concerning harsh and divisive speech, and have suggested that they try as a practice for, say, 1 month, not disparaging anyone. I've been dismayed at how stubborn a couple of these people were. They absolutely refused to follow my advice. One man explained to me that he was doing the world a service by pointing out other people's faults for them. By golly, it was his mission to fix the world by this means. I could not convince him how ill-conceived this was. People can become remarkably determined in their judgments. We've all heard of members of the same family who have refused to speak to each other for years. I was reading a book about anger written by Venerable Thubten Chodron, an American bhikkhuni. She observes that very few people maintain Buddhist vows so resolutely as family members locked into conflict with one another maintain their vow of silence. This week, I would like to talk on the topic dismembering conflict, in particular, Buddhist antidotes to the judgmental mind and to the anger that often accompanies it. I want to emphasize the role of empathy. Empathy is the near opposite of judgment, whereas judgment is the refusal to consider or consider further what is going on with the other. Empathy is the willingness and ability to put ourselves into the head of another and see what they are feeling, needing, and thinking. Interestingly, empathy does not seem to be an explicit Buddhist concept. I don't know a Pali word for empathy, for instance. It would seem to be aligned with the four Brahmaviharas, kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity, and I dare say Buddhist teachings seem regularly to circle around empathy. For instance, the Buddha justifies most of the key precepts in terms of what we would clearly call empathy in English. That is, the recognition that others have the same wishes, desires, and aversions that we have. Here is what he said.
Here, householders, a noble disciple reflects thus, I am one who wishes to live, who does not wish to die. I desire happiness and am averse to suffering. Since I am one who wishes to live and averse to suffering, if someone were to take my life, that would not be pleasing and agreeable to me. Now, if I were to take the life of another, of one who wishes to live, who does not wish to die, who desires happiness and is averse to suffering, that would not be pleasing and agreeable to the other either. What is displeasing and disagreeable to me is displeasing and disagreeable to the other too. How can I inflict upon another what is displeasing and disagreeable to me? Having reflected thus, he himself abstains from the destruction of life, exhorts others to abstain from the destruction of life, and speaks in praise of abstinence from the destruction of life. Thus, this bodily conduct of his is purified in three respects.
This passage is about destruction of life. He goes on to say basically the same thing with regard to someone stealing from me, committing adultery with my wives, damaging my welfare with false speech, dividing me from my friends with divisive speech, addressing me with harsh speech, and addressing me with frivolous speech. In effect, empathy is the basis of the precepts. Empathy connects directly to a lot of core Buddhist concepts, so it is the basis for kindness, metta, or compassion, karuna. It is also an antidote for anger or ill will and a source for forgiveness. It goes hand in hand with gaining wisdom about our own minds, feelings, needs, and thoughts. In fact, we can talk about self-empathy. It might seem strange to put ourselves into our own heads, but few people generally really know what they themselves are feeling, needing, or thinking. Recall that the tiff between George and Bob from last week was about Bob's failure to keep a tidy, mowed, and trimmed yard and his having a substandard car in his driveway. George responded with judgment and angry words, and the battle was on. However, I also leaked some information that George was not privy to, that Bob was seriously sick and had lost his job as a result, lost his health insurance as a result of that, and was physically and financially unable to meet the good neighbor standards George expected. If George's understanding were complete, he might have handled this quite differently. In fact, it is perhaps George who is not living up to standards of being a good neighbor, which would entail helping Bob out in whatever way he could, at least bringing him some chicken soup. Of course, George would not have understood the situation fully unless Bob or someone else explained it to him. The point is that through judgment, George had made himself unreceptive to any explanation that would exonerate Bob. Now, Buddhism has a lot of resources for promoting harmony and avoiding conflict. These are generally cultivated individually over time, but have become part of Buddhist culture. We can call Buddhism at a fundamental level a nonviolent culture. As Buddhists, we share basic values, kindness, compassion, and the rest, renunciation and harmlessness, wisdom, virtue, and serenity. We practice refuge, precepts, and making of merit. We study the Dhamma and meditate to gain a deep understanding of the nature of the human condition. The Buddha also advocates performing our societal roles as employer, husband or wife, child, teacher, with full responsibility and uprightness. The Buddha gave monastics a variety of tools for avoiding conflict and for resolving conflicts individually and at the communal level, such as avoiding schisms. We will look at some of these, but especially teachings around right speech. One of the ways to avoid conflict is simply to avoid or back out of passing judgment in the first place through establishing greater patience and kindness in our minds. Another is to restore empathy for the object of our judgment. Another is to push our mind towards self-empathy, largely by reminding ourselves of the spiritual cost we incur in harboring ill will. Still another is to take great care in how we act in body or speech so that, even if we are unable to remove the resentment or anger, we can remain harmless and not escalate the situation. I want to look at these techniques today. It'll be noticed that the primary burden in resolving the conflict is put on us, not on the other. We resolve the conflict by dismembering our role in it. This actually runs counter to the way most of us think if we've already taken the steps of judgment and anger, which is, he made me angry. It's his fault. In fact, no one can make us angry. We choose to be angry and can control anger. Patience and kindness are principal values in Buddhism. Patience allows us to hold off on judgmental thinking, to keep options open as we develop understanding. The Dhammapada tells us,
he insulted me, he hit me, he beat me, he robbed me. For those who brood on this, hostility isn't stilled. He insulted me, he hit me, he beat me, he robbed me. For those who don't brood on this, hostility is stilled.
Patience keeps us, even if we feel some resentment, for instance, by George at the side of Bob's yard, from reaching the moment of judgment. We learn to tolerate the situation and take the time to understand it fully. Patience, when we feel the anger arising, generally entails stepping back from the situation. Often we have to physically remove ourselves from the situation until we simmer down. Our meditation practice is also invaluable. We settle ourselves in the breath, find that still point, and relax. If anger has already risen, we should remember that anger actually gives us the opportunity to learn. This is the great thing about suffering. We learn from it. Adept meditators can use this occasion to study anger. Rather than centering ourselves around the breath, we move that center to the anger itself. What is this? We can ask that about anything. What does anger feel like in the body? We will notice tightness, especially around the chest, blood rushing to the head. What is the mind doing? We'll notice dis-ease, a kind of thrashing, wanting to strike out. But we should not get caught up in the story that is almost always present. We generally find that the anger appears to us quite insubstantial as just a mental disposition and a few bodily sensations signifying nothing, and soon we cannot even find it. Likewise, this is an opportunity for meditating on kindness, as the Buddha mentions.
We shall abide providing that person with a mind imbued with loving kindness, and starting with him, we shall abide pervading the all-encompassing world with a mind imbued with loving kindness, abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility, and without ill will.
With regard to the initial resentment, the Buddha also recommends,
Bhikkhus, there are these five ways of removing resentment by which a bhikkhu should entirely remove resentment when it has arisen toward anyone. What five?
1.
One should develop kindness for the person one resents.
2.
One should develop compassion for the person one resents.
3.
One should develop equanimity toward the person one resents.
4.
One should disregard the person one resents and pay no attention to him.
5.
One should apply the idea of the ownership of karma to the person one resents, thus, this venerable one is the owner of his karma, the heir of his karma. He has karma as his origin, karma as his relative, karma as his resort. He will be the heir of any karma he does, good or bad. These are the five ways of removing resentment by which a bhikkhu should entirely remove resentment when it has arisen toward anyone.
This mentions three of the four Brahma-viharas that we cultivate in Buddhism in order to bring into every situation: kindness, already discussed, compassion, and equanimity. Since judgment is capped with ill will, this also keeps judgment at bay. We know that kindness and the other Brahma-viharas develop on the basis of a lot of inner work, in particular in developing selflessness and weakening greed, hatred, and delusion. The fourth factor, ignoring the person who would cause resentment, is more like patience. The fifth factor, having to do with ownership of karma, actually takes us to another of the ways the Buddha provides for us to untangle the conditions that lead to conflict, and that is in developing empathy, which you knew we would get around to. If we've already made a demon of this person, then we assume he has committed some kind of unforgivable transgression and is harboring a great deal of ill will himself. By reflecting on karma, we are acknowledging the suffering that that entails, and we see that this person is already in pain. Then we will see that this pain is the cause of his transgression. It's not targeted specifically at us. This can be the beginning of empathy for that person. Suppose Bob really is an enemy of evil intentions. We really don't know that because we haven't shown a lot of empathy. But how do we know what this whole matter looks like from his perspective? The Buddha points out that, in view of anger's karmic implications, in responding with anger, we are doing to ourselves just what our most ill-intentioned foe would want for us. In other words, our anger is unwholesome karma. It leads to our own harm. In fact, anger is experienced immediately as suffering. It puts us in a hell-like state, and if this were to become habituated, that is where it would lead us. This also works the other way. Suppose Bob really is an enemy of ill intentions, then he is himself caught up in unwholesome karma in a hell-like state. Why do we need to wish him further harm? Still, another way to avoid conflict is available even if we're unable to remove the underlying resentment or anger that would be our contribution to the conflict. This is not to escalate the situation. By taking care in how we respond to the situation in body or speech, even while not in mind. Through restraint, we can remain harmless. The Buddha has a lot to say about right speech. It's one of the 8 factors of the Buddhist path, which aims in particular at controlling false, harsh, divisive, and frivolous speech, all of which lead to conflict in one way or another. Divisive speech is distinguished in this context because not only does it tend to trigger adverse reactions in others, but it is a blunt instrument of retribution. Once judgment and anger arise, we seek to harm the offender, and divisive speech is the means of choice for achieving this. The Buddha describes divisive speech as follows.
Having heard something here, he repeats it elsewhere in order to divide those people from these. Or having heard something elsewhere, he repeats it to those people in order to divide them from these. Thus he is one who divides those who are united, a creator of divisions, one who enjoys factions, delights in factions, a speaker of words that create factions.
Divisive speech may target individual people, but also entire groups of people. It can also occur quite casually as part of frivolous speech, often as an attempt at humor or wit, or it can be used as a way of building countervailing group solidarity. In the situation in which a conflict has arisen, it is frequently used as a way of degrading the reputation of the party with which we are in conflict. Many people routinely speak ill of others in an attempt to build personal self-esteem or to reassure themselves of their own righteousness. In this function, it may fix our judgment of the other even more firmly. Divisive speech is one of the great engines that grows conflict into a widening circle. With online communications, this can proceed quite quickly. In summary, the course of conflict from our perspective proceeds from resentment to judgment to anger to retribution. This is disrupted by patience, by kindness, and by the other Brahma Viharas, and by contemplation of the ownership of karma. Should the process reach anger, we have techniques for resolving anger. Should that not suffice, we can control retributive behavior through observation of precepts, particularly concerning right speech. If we refuse to further enact the conflict at this point, we can revisit the preceding steps. So next week, I would like to offer a final talk on conflict and its resolution, one that deals with the societal implications of conflict. ¶¶